want him, I like him, and I care about him enough to push those first two thoughts aside. The front door flings open, Ashley's and Julia's laughs competing for most likely to piss off Mr. Dorner, and we peel apart as they bound inside, loaded with Target totes. "Smells like heaven," Ashley says, whizzing past. Miles and I exchange a look, both apparently sensing some kind of mischief afoot. We pick up our bowls and follow them to the living room, where they empty their totes onto the rug. An air mattress, a pump, a couple of vacuum-sealed pillows, a blue blazer, a gold chenille blanket, and two mini desktop fans fall out, followed by some toiletries and a belt. "Are you planning a very specific heist?" I ask.
"I thought about buying a pullout to replace this garbage sofa," Julia says, "but I didn't want to be presumptuous."
"Oh, yeah, you wouldn't want to be presumptuous," Miles deadpans.
"Hey, be nice," Julia says. "It's temporary. As soon as I get a job, I'll start apartment hunting."
He rubs his brow. "I have to get to work. We'll talk later."
"You know where to find me,"
she says, leaning over the couch to gather her laundry. Miles turns, shaking his head and still forking pesto into his mouth as he heads toward the front door. I set my own bowl down on the coffee table.
"Do you need help with that?"
"Nope,"
Julia says.
"Just looking for somewhere else to put this stuff. The living room's getting a bit unwieldy."
Ashley snorts. "A bit." Julia's moving toward the closet. The closet, where I keep the dress. My heart rattles against my ribcage like one of those New Year's Eve clappers. She reaches for the pocket doors, seemingly in slow motion.
"No, wait!"
I lunge for her. I don't make it in time. Not even close. For the first time since the day Miles helped me haul my stuff over here, the closet door slides all the way open from the wrong side. The side packed so Tetris tight that the absence of the door triggers an avalanche of white, cream, ivory blush. Gift bags, boxes of taper candles, tea lights, a crate of biodegradable cutlery, palm leaf plates, organza, an ungodly amount of organza. The amount you'd need to film a monster movie where the town predator was a sentient wedding dress hell-bent on swallowing women whole. Me. I am the woman who was supposed to be swallowed by that dress, and now it's cascading directly into Julia's face, a raging waterfall of my mistakes. It takes several seconds, during which she's utterly frozen, for everything to come tumbling out. It's like something out of I Love Lucy or the Dick Van Dyke Show. When it's finally over, we're all left staring. "Oh, honey," Ashley says. "Tell me you didn't keep the dress." 21.
"I just haven't had time to figure out what to do with it," I cry, brushing past Julia to start stacking things back up. "No,"
Julia yelps, yanking a box of thrifted and laundered ivory cloth napkins out of my hand.
"You can't just put this stuff back in there. Pandora's box has been opened, Daphne. And Pandora's contents aren't going to fit in this living room with your big-ass life raft," I say.
"You're going to have to get rid of it before you move anyway," Ashley points out. Julia's eyes snap to me.
"You're moving?"
"Possibly," I say, "but not until after the summer, at the earliest. I've got time to deal with this stuff." Ashley faces Julia.
"Maybe you could move into her room."
For Miles's sake, I'm relieved to see Julia scrunch her nose in dismay.
"No way. Staying here is a short-term solution only."
Now that I have an in, I ask, "Why the sudden interest in moving here anyway?" Julia sucks her teeth for a second.
"Can I tell you something without it getting back to Miles?"
"Ooh, gossip." Ashley pantomimes, zipping her lips. "Fine," I say. "But if you can tell me, I'm sure you can tell him." Julia snorts. "I love my brother more than anyone on the planet, but there are things it's better for him not to know."
"Such as?"
Ashley presses. "I've been almost moving here for years." "Weren't you in college in Wisconsin?" I ask.
"I was miserable," she says. "And I couldn't tell Miles. He'd co-signed my loans."
"He would have understood," I insist.
I know, she says. He babies me. And frankly, I'm not a huge fan of cleaning up my own messes, but the thing is, when I make one and Miles rushes in with a mop, he's always leaving something behind. I shake my head. I don't understand. When he graduated from high school, she says, he was supposed to move to Colorado with a couple of his friends. Last minute, he decided not to go, and I know it was because of me, because I would have been stuck with my parents. He waited until I left for college to even leave the state. He moved out here and he loved it. So when school started sucking, I was going to come too. But then he started dating Petra. Didn't you two get along? I ask, surprised. Petra gets along with everyone, Julia retorts. But she's also so fucking flighty. And I say that as a flighty person. I get sick of jobs, I get sick of roommates, I get sick of having bangs 4 days after getting them. Ashley says, well, that's everyone. But Petra, she's next level. Once she and Miles took a trip to Iceland and decided just to stay indefinitely for like 2 months. I'm not even sure if it was legal. And then last winter, their 2-week trip to Uruguay lasted 5. I didn't want to move here if he didn't really want to be here, she explains, because I know him and he'd feel stuck. But some things changed in my life recently, and now feels like the right time. But if something comes up, if Miles wants to move to Iceland, I just don't want to be the reason he doesn't. I can't. He's given up too much for me over the years. My heart keens. I know what it's like to have all your family concentrated in one person, to want what's best for them after they've given you so much. But having heard Miles' side of things, I can't help but wish he knew how his sister felt. To him, he's the brother who ran away. To her, he's the one who stays, even when he shouldn't. You should tell him how you feel, I say.
Interesting sentiment.
She grabs her water bottle for a long sip. I can think of some other scenarios where it might apply. Ashley rescues me with a firm clap. Okay, back to the issue at hand. This stuff. Right, Julia says. Here's what we do. We photograph and list everything we can online. Then I'll ship things out as they're bought, as a thank you for letting me stay here. And I've got plenty of room for this stuff at my place in the meantime, Ashley volunteers. So we catalog it, list it, and then I'll store it until it sells. Come on, Julia says, reading my hesitancy. Wouldn't it feel good to just let this stuff all go? I scan the stuff in question. What am I waiting for? This, I think. Them. To not be alone. To have friends bear witness to the death of this dream. I take the box from Julia. I'm ready. She claps.
I'll get the wine.
Ashley cues up a playlist she's titled You're Divorced, Not Dead, which has the urgency of a spin class soundtrack. Julia pours us each a glass of Sauvignon Blanc, filling mine to the brim, and absolutely everything in the closet gets pulled out and laid across the living room floor. We move lamps around to get good lighting and snap pictures like every piece is an element of a crime scene. I jot down quick descriptions, which Julia promises to post to a few different resale apps, and honestly, it's kind of fun. 3 glasses of wine and several hours later, we finally get to the dress itself. Well, obviously, you have to try it on, Ashley says.
Yes!
Julia claps again. I shove the fabric at her. You can if you want. She's not the one who chose it, Ashley cuts in.
You did. Don't you want one last look at it?
More importantly, Julia cuts in, don't you want your friends to see you looking drop-dead gorgeous in it before it's Halloween and you're driving past a frat house where some teenager in a Bride of Frankenstein wig is puking down the front of it? She has a point. No one's ever seen me in the dress except my mom and my ex-almost mother-in-law. If I'm sending it off, I could at least give it some fanfare.
Try it on, Ashley chants.
Julia immediately joins in.
Try it on! Try it on!
Okay, fine, I relent. I'll try it on! With a giddy squeal, Julia pushes the wadded-up dress back into my arms, and Ashley leans forward to top off my wine.
Atta girl, she says.
I turn and stuff myself in the bathroom to shuck off my work clothes.
It takes a few tries to get the dress over my head, the layers of silk and organza twisting around me in increasingly nonsensical ways, until finally I manage to push my face through it like I'm clumsily hatching from a $3,000 egg. I hadn't even wanted a wedding gown. I'd planned to find a cream silk or satin dress for a couple $100. But Peter's mom had wanted me to at least try on some wedding dresses, and surprisingly, my mom agreed. Both of them had flown out for a weekend to Virginia, and the three of us, Mom, Melly, and I, spent 6 exhausting hours sipping our way through the free champagne and Perrier of Richmond's finest bridal boutiques. I'd been prepared to thank them both for their time and reassert my plans to just get a non-wedding dress until our last stop of the day, a shop specializing in vintage dresses that Melly had read about online. Mom helped me put the dress on, and when she'd finished with the button at my nape, we both looked into the mirror and fell silent. She squeezed my shoulders and took a long, shuddering breath, her version of bursting into tears. Then she said, in a quiet, unsteady voice, "You look like Grace Kelly." "I look nothing like Grace Kelly," I whispered back. "It's the one," Mom said. "Isn't it?" The dress was $3,000, and I'd already, after much protestation, allowed Peter and the Collinses to pay for nearly everything. We would have had to have a courthouse wedding if Mom and I were footing the bill, and I was fine with that, but Peter's family was traditional, and I wanted them to be happy. "I think I'll go with something simpler," I said, a knot in my throat. Mom sighed and pulled me in, resting her chin on my shoulder and holding my gaze in the mirror. "Let me do this." "You've already done everything," I told her. "Absolutely everything. And you don't even believe in all this." "Sweetie," she smoothed my hair over my shoulder. "I believe in you. I believe you should and will have everything you've ever wanted, if you're not too scared to go after it." It was the first time, one of very few, that I'd wondered whether Mom really was as happy on her own as she seemed to be. "It's the one," she said again, kissing the side of my head. "You're my one." "You're mine too," I said. She smiled. "No, baby," she said. "Now you've got two." There had been no, "I always told you not to rely on men" from her when things came crashing down. There had been only kindness, comfort, scathing criticisms of Peter. I still felt guilty about the dress, but whenever I brought up the possibility of paying her back, she joked that she actually owed me money since I'd never needed her to bail me out of jail or replace a garage door I drove through like a normal teen. The way my mom talked about normal teens made it clear that she'd been the kind they write movies about, who sneak out bedroom windows and throw keggers in the woods. As I'm getting the dress over my shoulders, Ashley knocks and shouts something that sounds like a question at me through the door, but it's unintelligible through the cocoon of fabric I'm fighting against.
"Hold on," I call back. "Give me a minute."
Another muffled reply. I finally manage to shake out all the layers and turn my back to the mirror to feel around for the zipper. It jams 3 times before I coax it to my shoulder blades. Then I turn to examine the smooth silk bodice in the mirror over the sink, the high boat neck and bare arms, the flare of the skirt, the pockets the shop seamstress had added. I'd been so excited about the pockets. For a second, I let myself feel the sadness. I'm mourning the Victorian house with its porch and the gorgeous new kitchen where Peter would cook me dinner, the kids we might have had and the parents we would have become, the way that walking through the front door would feel like stepping into a warm hug. But honestly, the dress itself doesn't have the same effect it used to, possibly because it's now a size and a half too small. The seams straining, my cleavage pushed up like I'm a Tessa Dare heroine courting scandal. Except Tessa's cover models look sexy and courageous. I look baffled and ridiculous. I let myself out of the bathroom and sweep into the living room with a dramatic, "Ta-da!" It's incredibly anticlimactic, wearing your skin-tight wedding gown into an empty room. Hello? I creep toward the kitchen. It's empty, though Ashley's phone is on the counter, her playlist still blaring out Love is a Battlefield via Bluetooth speaker. I traipse back into the living room, but there's no sign of them. Behind me, the front door clanks open. I turn and stop short. So does Miles. Hi, I say.
Hi?
He says it like a question, a look akin to horror on his face. Probably because I'm drifting around the apartment in a gown for a wedding that never happened while Pat Benatar serenades me from the kitchen. I'm not wearing this, I say quickly.
Okay,
he says. I mean, I am wearing this, but not by myself, I explain. He looks around the empty apartment. Your sister and Ashley were here. I also look around the empty apartment, searching for proof I'm not having a Miss Havisham moment and instead finding wedding supplies everywhere. They wanted to see the dress, so I put it on, and now they're somewhere. He finally cracks a smile, takes off his sweatshirt, and tosses it over a chair. I saw them getting into a cab downstairs. Apparently, they needed milkshake supplies. Which explained what Ashley was shouting at me when I was wrestling with the dress. Ah. I cross my arms in front of myself.
I'll pay you to wear that to Peter and Petra's wedding,
he says. I'll pay you more, I say. His grin splits wide.
It's a nice dress. You look nice.
I blush furiously. I look like an overstuffed canolo. His head cocks.
What's a canolo?
The singular version of cannoli, I say.
So you look delicious,
he says. It used to fit better, or my vision's just getting better. Or maybe it's just the longer this cuts off my oxygen, the prettier the hallucinations get.
You look beautiful,
he says. Then, with a slight twitch at the corner of his mouth,
even better than an Italian pastry.
As his gaze tracks over me, I get an unadulterated hit of his spicy, sweet scent and lurch toward the bathroom. I'm gonna go change. Inside, I lock the door and face the mirror. Red splotches have spread from the neckline up my throat. They basically spell out, I still want Miles Nowick. I push aside thoughts of what happened between us in his truck and reach back between my shoulders for the zipper. It glides down a few inches, then snags. I turn my back to the mirror and look over my shoulder as I wrestle the zipper over the bump in the fabric. I manage to tug it back up the tracks an inch, but when I draw it down again, it snags even worse. It won't budge, and the bodice feels tighter than it did a minute ago. The more I mess with the zipper, the more panicked I become. My skin feels tender under the seams, my rib cage hurts, I can't get a good breath, and the dress is stuck. 22. I barrel out of the bathroom and smash into Miles, who's been waiting in the hallway like a nervous first-time father pacing the hospital floors.
You're still in it,
he says. It's stuck, I say. I think I broke the zipper and the dress is too tight and I can't breathe and it's stuck.
It's okay.
Oh, is it? I say. Then I feel better. He's turning me by the elbow.
I'll get it. Just try to breathe.
He gathers my hair off my neck so carefully his fingers never brush skin.
Can you hold this out of the way?
I pin my hair against the back of my head, shoulders and arms throbbing as my heart pumps too much blood to my extremities. Miles pinches the two sides of the fabric and wiggles the zipper until it gives. At mid-back, it catches.
Shit, hold on.
More pinching, wiggling, straining. I close my eyes and focus on my breath. The zipper goes up and glides down to the same snag.
Try to stay still,
he says. You keep pulling me off balance, I say.
Do you have any chapstick?
He asks.
Can your mouth moisturization wait a minute?
I cry.
Not really. It's for the zipper, Daphne.
In the medicine cabinet, I tell him.
We shuffle together into the cramped bathroom, him holding up the back of my dress as we go. I hand the tube to him, and he does whatever it is he thinks he's going to do with it, then goes back to wrestling the zipper. He loses purchase and smacks an elbow into the wall behind me with a grunt of pain. It's too cramped in here. We shuffle step back into the hall. He tries again, his frustrated huff turning into a laugh. What? I ask over my shoulder. Now I can't see anything. He drags me by the skirt through his bedroom door, bumping the lights on. Can you lean over the dresser? He asks. Seriously? I say. I need more leverage, he says, and every time I pull, you come with me. Dear God, what did I do to deserve this? Oh, right. I lied about being in a relationship with this man, then jumped his bones at a lavender farm to upset my ex-fiancé. That could have done it. I brace my hands against the top of his dresser. He sets one palm to my hip, holding me steady while he pulls again, gets the zipper to move for several blissful millimeters before it catches again, his grip on me tightening. Distract me, I say under my breath. I promise we'll get this off of you, he says. Wrong kind of distraction. I'm feeling unbearably stupid right now, Miles, so you're gonna have to do better than that. Tell me something awful. He laughs. Okay. What about this? When Petra and I got your save the date in the mail, she told me she didn't want to get married, and I was like, cool, no worries, because I thought she meant in general, not specifically that she didn't want to marry me. I drop my face toward the dresser. My pained groan gives way to something more forceful, the emotion shaking through my shoulders. Shit, he says. I'm sorry, not helpful. Miles takes hold of both my hips. Hey. I straighten up, shaking my head as the laughter racks me, tears leaking from my eyes. Daphne, he murmurs behind me, still tender and sweet, pulling me in, my back to his chest, and coiling his arms around my waist. Miles, I finally manage, spinning in his grip. What was the chapstick for? Another fit of laughter throttles my voice. He registers it. His mouth opens and closes. I thought it might smooth the track. You lubed my zipper, I say. Actually, he says, I very specifically asked about chapstick so that neither of us would have to say that sentence. My forehead hits his collarbone as the giggles double me over. His hand slides up my back, goosebumps trailing along behind his touch to rest at the base of my neck. His laugh hums through me, too. You were just ready for that, I say. How many roommates have you had to do this for? Dozens. His arms loosen and he turns me again. But you're the first who had chapstick. He pinches the zipper and gives a soft tug. After all that huffing and struggling and bracing, the zipper glides down to the small of my back, Miles's knuckles dragging along my skin all the way. I shiver at the sensation, prickle with full body awareness of him. He doesn't pull away immediately, and I catch my weight shifting back into his touch. His fingers unfurl, his palm flattening against my low back. The bodice of the dress is gaping loose, gravity pulling the straps down my arms as the weight of the skirt draws everything toward the ground. I catch the bust against my chest, pinning it to me as I turn toward him. Thanks. Here. He flinches away from me, avoids my eyes as he snatches a loose gray t-shirt from his open top drawer. When he pulls it over my head, his ginger snap smell engulfs me, and he tugs it down over the dress. When I let go of the bust, the whole lacy concoction pools at my feet. I get my arms through the t-shirt sleeves, and Miles helps me step out of the skirt, gently untucking my hair from the collar. His eyes lift back to mine, and the room thrums. Thank you, I say again, this time a whisper. I'm going to need this back, he teases quietly. That's been my favorite shirt since I was 10. I register the front of it for the first time, a crackly, vinyl, cartoon camel smoking a gigantic cigarette. Chortling, I meet his gaze. This is your favorite shirt from childhood? A walking nicotine advertisement? His smile widens. His fingers move absently to my chin,
and I feel myself being drawn into him, our stomachs connecting, his heart pattering through me. "It's a camel, Daphne," he says wryly. "In sunglasses." "I'll change immediately," I say, playing along. "No, no," he says. "Keep it as long as you want. What's mine is yours." I suppress a grin. "See, this is why all these locals have added you to their wills." He frowns. "Sometimes you make it sound like I'm a snake oil salesman." I grab his arm. "That's not what I mean at all."
"Then what do you mean?"
he asks. "I mean that you're nice," I say. He laughs.
"This again."
"I mean," I say more fervently, "you're probably the only person I've ever met who's genuinely curious about everyone he meets and makes them feel interesting and welcome and like they should be confident in what they do. You make them feel like growing corn or making cherry salsa or recommending books is a superpower."
"If you're good at those things," he says, "it is."
"Exactly," I murmur. "That's how you actually feel." The only other person I've ever known with that particular skill wields it like a shield, or a tax he's paying you, a cut of him just big and bright enough to guarantee you won't ask for more. "I just think," I say to Miles, "you like people almost as much as they like you, and it makes being around you feel like standing in the sunlight." His mouth softens. Briefly, he studies the space between our feet.
"You feel like sunlight too."
I snort. "No, I don't."
"No," he agrees. "You don't. You're more like Lake Michigan."
"Cold and bracing," I say. His voice drops.
"Cool and refreshing."
"Shocking and painful," I say.
"Surprising and exciting,"
he counters, now close enough that I smell the post-shift glass of red wine on his breath, close enough that I become the moth to his irresistible glow, trying to resist the pull to move closer. I tip my head toward the living room, the mess, mine and Julia's. I seize the opportunity for a distraction from this heady feeling. "Have you managed to talk to her about what she's really doing here?" He exhales heavily with a half step back.
"I've tried. She's still pretending there's no big reason other than scraping me up off the floor."
He forces a smile that makes my heart feel like it's folding in half.
"You ready to kick her out?"
"I like having her here, I promise." He nods. "Can I do anything?" I ask. Now his smile softens. He touches my chin again.
"Nah," he says. "This is enough."
"I'm not doing anything," I point out. The corner of his mouth twitches.
"Then why do I feel better?"
The moment swells. Now I step back, the floor chilly beneath my soles. "Thanks again," I say, "for lubing my zipper."
"Anytime,"
he says. 23. Wednesday, July 24th. 24 days until the readathon. Aside from the radio silence about my Ocean City Library application, I'm having a streak of uncommonly good luck. On Sunday, Miles surprised me and a less than thrilled Julia with a drive down to a little town called North Bear Shores for a bookstore event with a romance writer Sadie had turned me on 2 years ago. After the signing, the shop owner and her geology professor wife ended up falling in love with Miles, obviously, and making a donation toward the readathon. On Monday, two children's book authors agreed to send videos for readathon prizes, while a third offered to do a live video call with the kids. Tuesday, our monthly Fortnite tournament kicked off with our highest turnout ever, and today, when Maya dropped by the desk to pick up her holds, I'd finally managed to convince her to come to next week's YA book club. Mom screams with excitement when I tell her on our call as I walk home. That, or she accidentally drops some free weights close to her toes.
"That's great, honey," she says. "I know that kid's been a tough nut to crack. She's just so shy. But the other kids in the group are really sweet.
I say. And a couple are homeschooled, so she's probably never met them, which could be good. A clean slate. God, once when you were having a hard time at a new school, I remember asking you if you wanted to be homeschooled, Mom says. I snort. When would you have had time to homeschool me? I wouldn't have, she says. But you were so unhappy at school. I didn't know what to do. I wanted to just rescue you from your misery. Do you remember what you said to me? I never even remember homeschooling being on the table, I say. You said you'd miss your teachers too much. She bursts into breathless laughter, which turns into a groan of exertion, followed by the clank of weights hitting the floor. You were shy, but you were brave. I was a little nerd, you can say it, I say. Back then, they used to call it a pleasure to have in class, she tells me. My phone beeps, and I step under an awning. Hold on a second, I tell her, blocking the glare to read the screen. What the hell? Is everything okay? Mom asks. Yep, I say, too brightly. Everything's great, except that my dad's trying to call me, and it's not 2 weeks after a major holiday when I'd normally hear from him. I fire a text his way. Sorry, on the phone. He replies immediately, an extreme rarity. Give me a call when you get a sec. Fun news. Anxiety corkscrews through me. Fun news in Jason Roberts speak is usually, hey, I'm dating a 26-year-old. Not for long. Or, I made a friend who owns a catamaran, so I'm going out of the country for a while. Send you a postcard when I hit dry land. He won't. Daphne? Mom asks. No, everything's fine. She and Dad aren't mortal enemies or anything, but she stopped having contact with him pretty much the moment I turned 18. And as good as my mom is at empathizing, laughing through the shitstorms in life, she's always gone out of her way to not trash Dad. For my sake, I know, but sometimes I just want her to stop being supermom and just agree with me that he's the worst. So mostly, we just don't talk about him. Well, look, she says, I'm happy for you, and I'm proud of you, and I love you. And you have to go? I auto-fill. I do, she says. I'm going to the beach tomorrow with some friends, but talk next week? No problem, I tell her. Love you. Love you more, she says, hanging up before I can argue. When I pass the taffy green fairy tale cottage, the morning glories vining around the picket fence are in full bloom, little birds cheeping from the branches like one more good omen. On a whim, I check the online listing. The price has recently dropped $50,000, but it's still well beyond my real life range. Still, it feels good to daydream. To picture myself in a place like that, hosting dinners and watching action movies, grabbing chai from the cafe up the street and filling vases with fresh-cut lavender, drinking wine out back with friends during lightning bug season. I can almost see it. I can almost see a life here.
Any big plans for your birthday?
Harvey asks Ashley as we settle around the poker table several hours later with the others. It's your birthday? I say. When? She groans.
A week from Saturday, 43. And no to big plans. It just so happens to fall on the weekend Mulder and I get back from visiting my mom in Sedona, so he'll be at his dad's place, and I'll be at home rotting my brain to the tune of Bravo reality TV.
Why would you be home? I say. We should do something. Around her cigar, Lenore says,
You're not gonna win this battle.
I've always hated my birthday, Ashley explains. It's just one more reminder of how little progress I've made. I'm in exactly the same spot I was this time last year, looking at the same four walls in the same house in the same town, only minus a husband.
Oh, sweetie, that's not true at all, Barb pipes in. You left a stagnant marriage. You started therapy. You got Mulder through a tough year, and now you've brought Daphne into our little circle.
And it's not a day to celebrate progress anyway, I insist. It's a day to celebrate existence. We have to do something. Aren't the roles a bit reversed here? Her brow arches. I'm the fun take charge one. You are, I agree. But you can't Ashley yourself, so someone else has to.
I don't want to go out.
She sticks out her bottom lip. Then we won't go out, I relent. What if I come over and we paint? Her face scrunches, an expression akin to disgust. Like Bob Ross landscapes? Like a room, I say. In your house. You said Duke never wanted you to, right? And you're tired of looking at the same four walls, so pick a wall color and I'll come help paint. I'm terrible at painting, she says. I get too impatient and fuck up the cut-in. Well, you're in luck because I'm amazing at the cut-in, I say. She snorts. You would be. I'm not insulted by that, I tell her. She considers for a beat. So you'll come do all the hard parts, and I'll pour the wine, while we watch the housewives throw drinks and scream just own it at each other? Sure, I say. Anyone else want in? Lenore guffaws. I'm good, but you girls enjoy yourselves. Harvey and Barb nod agreement. Okay, Vincent, Ashley says after a moment of consideration. Saturday night after next, I'll pick a color. You wear your adorable friendship montage overalls. I don't have those, I say. Well, you've got all week.
I know a great farm supply store, Barb offers helpfully.
Now, can we please get to the cards? Harvey says. I'm feeling lucky tonight.
And he is pretty lucky that night. He wins 6 hands. I win the game. We get rained out on Sunday. Miles didn't tell us what we were supposed to do, only that it requires good weather.
Think you could call off on Thursday?
He asks me as we're making our respective tea and coffee in the kitchen. Ordinarily, I'd hate to call off, but with Ashley out all week, work's been a little boring, and there isn't much on the library's calendar that day, so I give in. I still wake up at 7, even without an alarm, and decide to ease into my day reading and sipping iced tea at one of Fika's sidewalk tables. On a whim, I order matcha and like it more than I expected, but still decide to go back in for my usual before walking home. The thoroughly facial-pierced barista looks up and calls brightly,
You're back!
I am, I say.
Another matcha, he says. Or iced chai with milk?
Chai, please, I say. Plus an iced meal and an iced hazelnut latte.
Big day,
he teases. For my roommates, I say.
Got it.
He's scribbling my name on all 3 cups without asking for it. I feel an embarrassing amount of pride at having become a regular someplace new, on my own. How much do I owe you? I ask when he brings the finished drinks to me.
On the house today, he says.
What? Are you sure? I ask. He looks around, then leans in.
My manager isn't here. There's no one in line behind you to demand their own free drinks, and you're a good tipper. I'm sure.
Well, thanks. I stuff the $10 bill in my hand, part of last Wednesday night's winnings, into the jar.
Jonah, he puts in without me asking.
Thanks, Jonah, I say. He beams.
Have a good day, Daphne.
On my walk home, my dad tries to call me, and I accidentally hang up. I forgot to call him back last week, which isn't like me, but it's not like him to call me, period. At this point, we're sustaining more of a casual texts every few months kind of relationship. At a stoplight, I text him. Sorry, can I call you back in just a few? I'm terrible at multitasking, even when the 2 tasks at hand aren't as demanding as A, navigating small talk with my semi-estranged father, and B, navigating crowds of ice cream sandwich carrying out-of-towners zigzagging in every direction. No need, Dad replies. Just wanted to confirm the address your mom gave me. So he's mailing me something, right when I finally started clearing out the wedding junk. If this surprise package is anything like Dad's last few, I can look forward to an intriguing assortment of miracle cure vitamins, essential oils, and weed gummies I did not ask for and likely are an actual crime to mail. For good measure, sometimes he throws in something vaguely nostalgic but ultimately misguided, like a yellow snow hat he found in his attic and is convinced belonged to me as a kid. In that case, I so thoroughly did not recognize the hat that the only logical explanation was it belonged to whoever owned the house before Dad, and since he could only afford the place due to the fact that a violent crime had been committed there, you'd better believe that hat went straight into the trash. I did, however, briefly burn the sage he sent me in the general vicinity of the trash can before tossing it in after the snow cap. I figure we reached net zero on that particular gift. Inside our apartment building, I check my phone again. The address Dad sent for confirmation is, in fact, Miles's place. Still, I dial his number as I'm trudging upstairs, determined to talk him out of sending me anything. The call rings out. I try once more. A message prompts me to leave a voicemail as I reach our door. After the beep, I say, "Hey, Dad." My key jams in the lock, and it takes some wiggling to get it to turn. "Sorry I missed you. Just give me a call back when..." The door swings open. I don't open it. Someone on the other side does. A middle-aged woman with a 1960s-esque beehive and cleavage to her chin. She looks every bit as surprised to see me coming into my apartment as I am to see her already standing inside it.
"Daphne!"
she shouts with pure ecstasy. "Hi," I say, trying furiously to place her and getting nowhere. My dad steps out of the kitchen into view, slipping one hand over the woman's shoulder.
"Hey, kid,"
he says.
"Surprise!"
24. Thursday, August 1st, 16 days until the readathon. My gut instinct is to step back into the hallway, close the door, and try again, see if anything else greets me. Dad yanks me right into a hug, thwacking my back so heartily it makes me cough.
"You sick, kid?"
He draws back, gripping my shoulders as his sparkling green eyes give me a quick survey. "A little," I say, because suddenly I do feel feverish.
Come on in,
he says, like this isn't my home. He spins me toward the kitchen.
"You finally get to meet Starfire."
A wordless squeal emanates from behind him. He sidesteps, presenting with a full-arm flourish the woman who opened my apartment door. Several feet behind her, Miles hovers in the entryway, looking as flustered as I've seen him, which is to say, technically not very, but for Miles, every bit like a man who was just forced to let two strangers into his apartment. I barely have time to register Starfire's bubblegum pink lip gloss before she's wrapping me in a bone-crunching hug that smells like the inside of a Bath and Body Works minutes after a gaggle of preteens rolled through, hyped up on Frappuccinos.
"You are just so cute!"
She rocks me hard back and forth in time with her pronouncement. "Oh," I say, "thanks." When she releases me, she keeps one of my hands in hers, her long, baby blue fingernails slightly clawing into me.
"Finally," she says tearily. "At first, I thought you were the tall one."
She jerks her head over her shoulder toward Julia, whose face plainly projects, "I have already been through what you are currently experiencing." My eyes flick toward Dad, trying to communicate that I have no idea who this woman is. But my father and I never had the time to develop anything resembling an unspoken language. He just beams.
"You have no idea what it means to me to see my two girls together."
For one second, I genuinely wonder whether Starfire is a half-sister I never knew existed. But whereas all Dad's previous girlfriends easily could have fit that bill, Starfire has to be within a decade of Dad's own age, though with the kind of filler and Botox that make it impossible to tell whether she's 10 years younger or 10 years older than him.
"Should we go into the living room?"
Miles pipes up, already guiding Dad down the hallway.
"Daphne and I will grab some wine and snacks."
"Sounds great,"
Julia chimes in, dutifully looping an arm through Starfire's. Starfire, for her part, makes another wordless, baby-talk coo in the back of her throat and squeezes my cheek before she's dragged off, a huge grin turned over her shoulder all the way so that she keeps bumping into Julia and almost toppling over in her 4-inch blue spike heels. Miles ushers me into the kitchen, whispering,
"They just showed up."
"And you let them in?"
I whisper back.
"He said he was your dad,"
he hisses,
"and that you were expecting him. I didn't know what to do."
I mean, in the loosest interpretation of the word, I say, that's my father, but I'm never expecting him.
And Starfire? He asks.
The missing sixth member of the Spice Girls? I say.
You've never met her, he guesses.
Never even heard of her, I say.
Miles sighs and turns to open the wine cabinet. I grab a couple of glasses from the other cabinet. When I turn back, he's laughing to himself, shaking his head.
Should we take bets on who shows up next?
At this rate, I say, I won't be surprised if my dead great-aunt Mildred climbs through the window tonight.
Not even about the window part, he says. Was she a contortionist?
I'm just assuming ghosts have the Santa Claus effect where they can turn into jello and shimmy through tight spaces.
You ready for this? He asks.
And while I haven't told him a ton about my dad, he's clearly picked up on enough in the last 3 minutes.
No, I say. But once I make it through the first bottle of wine, I'll be better.
He sniffs the air.
Am I smelling?
I nod.
That's my dad, hotboxing in our apartment.
He winces.
Want me to ask him to stick his head out the window?
Be my guest, I say. In 15 minutes, he'll forget and light up again while he's mid-sentence, and you feel like you can't interrupt him. The sentence will last 20 minutes.
He touches my elbow.
Just text me if you need an out.
My brow lifts.
You'll cause a diversion? If I have to.
I turn toward the hall. He never stays long. This is probably a 30-minute interlude on their way somewhere better. We'll get it over with.
Or I will. You're not obligated to. I'll stay, he says. Unless you don't want me to.
No, I definitely want you to, I admit. It's just that I absolutely do not expect you to endure this.
He runs a hand over my elbow, and I do my best not to shiver. Someone once told me I'm very good with strangers. Come on.
As we walk into the living room, Dad blows out a puff of smoke. Julia's stuff has all been moved into a tower in the corner, the air mattress 3/4 deflated and balled up at the bottom so that our guests can sit on the couch, 2 pairs of intensely white teeth floating against sun-bronzed skin.
There she is,
Dad says, followed by a hacking cough.
Here I am.
I set the wine glasses on the coffee table before perching on the very edge of the chair perpendicular to the couch.
And you, and Starfire.
Starfire beams at me. Dad beams at Starfire. Miles and Julia exchange a bewildered glance.
These are for you,
Dad says, scooting forward. He balances his joint on the corner of the coffee table and produces an admittedly beautiful bouquet from down on the rug.
We thought they looked just like you.
Your aura, of course, Starfire puts in. It's hard to judge in pictures, but JJ was drawn to these, and we compared them to the picture he keeps in his wallet.
At my blank stare, Dad chimes in.
Your old senior photo.
News to me that Dad has a copy of that. I'm pretty sure Mom and I agreed they were so bad it wasn't worth getting any printed, and just sent the file for the least awkward one to my school to use. Thanks, I say stiffly, leaning over to accept the bouquet.
That's something I loved about him right away,
Starfire says dreamily, looking up at Dad as if a halo floats above his head. I've seen that look on plenty of girlfriends past.
He never shows up empty-handed.
As a kid, I loved that about him too. Until I realized his gifts were consolation prizes.
Yes, I canceled our spring break visit, but my buddy gave us tickets to an amusement park. I missed your choir concert, but isn't this candy my chocolatier girlfriend makes amazing?
I set the bouquet on the coffee table, and Julia jumps up.
I'll put that in water, she says, and flees the scene.
Miles, genius that he is, starts filling the wine glasses and asks,
So, how'd you two meet?
He sits back onto the other chair, mimicking my ready-to-run posture.
Starfire is my life coach.
Dad says, after a gulp. Starfire nods, a smile still stretched tight across her lips.
But we actually knew each other before that.
Apparently, we were married in a past life,
Dad says. Like, can you believe that coincidence? Starfire nods.
Several times.
Oh,
Miles says,
"Well, congratulations."
"I was an heiress on the Titanic,"
Starfire explains.
"And Jason was a handsome artist, but he was so, so poor. My social circles never would have approved, but we had a torrid affair, and he saved my life."
She goes back to nodding, a very earnest bobblehead. Miles and I make eye contact. He looks like he's trying so hard not to laugh, he might throw up instead.
"So just," I say,
"exactly the plot of the movie, then." Starfire's head cocks to one side.
"What movie?"
"What brings you into town?" Miles, with the assist. "You live in California, right?"
"That's right."
Dad relights his joint.
"But we're on our—"
"Excuse me,"
Miles cuts in, smiling pleasantly.
"Would you mind waiting to smoke until you're outside?"
He says it so warmly and naturally. He really does have a superpower. Just as unflappably affable, Dad says,
"Oh, sure, of course,"
and tucks the joint back in his t-shirt pocket.
"So, California?"
Miles says.
"Right,"
Dad says.
"But we're driving across the country to celebrate."
"Celebrate what?" I ask.
"Oh, Daffy,"
Starfire says, officially the first adult to ever abbreviate my two-syllable name that way.
"Our union."
Dad frowns, a vague look of hurt around his eyes.
"Didn't you get the card?"
"What card?" I say.
"The birthday card,"
he says.
"Where I told you we got married."
"You told me in a birthday card?" I say.
"You didn't see it?"
he says again, still the injured party.
"When was your birthday?"
Miles asks, brow furrowing.
"End of April," I say.
He frowns at that, no doubt doing the math, realizing I was already living with him. "I must have misplaced the card," I tell Dad. Actually, since his birthday cards rarely contain anything other than my name and his signature, when they come at all, I'd opted to put it exactly where I put the murder house beanie he'd mailed me last year, in the trash. The last thing I needed was another half-hearted gesture from a man who sort of loved me. The other last thing I needed was a reminder that I was turning 33 and had no one at all to celebrate it with. Starfire is still smiling, like if she lets even the corners of her lips touch, the apocalypse might be triggered. And after everything she endured on the Titanic, who can blame her for being so cautious? "So you're passing through," I say. "Headed somewhere fun?"
"Well, eventually," Dad says. "We're going to Starfire's family in Vermont, but we figured we'd stick around here until Monday, if you could stand to have us that long."
My skin prickles. My blood runs cold. I wonder if this is how animals feel when a tornado is brewing. I'd braced for this to be an offensively short pit stop. Now I realize it's so much worse. We're a free place to stay while they break up their transcontinental drive. "Here are some beautiful flowers that reminded me of you. Can I sleep on your couch?" This apartment is quickly becoming the set for a terrible sitcom. Dad's still talking, but I'm hearing his voice as the warble of Charlie Brown's teacher. "I'm sorry," I finally get out. "What did you say?"
"We're on no set schedule," Starfire says, "so we can stay as long as you want."
Out of the corner of my eye, I see Julia walking into the room with the flowers in a vase. She, very smartly, turns and heads right back into the kitchen. Dad says,
"We're so happy to be here, kid. Starfire's cousin, Sandra, says we have to go see the dunes while we're here."
"She's a psychic, too,"
Starfire tells me, nodding enthusiastically.
"Who?"
I say.
"Sandra,"
she says.
"She's got the gift."
Too bad she didn't warn them there was no space for them in our apartment.
"I've got a bit myself,"
Starfire goes on.
"My therapist says I'm an expath."
"You mean empath?"
I ask, momentarily distracted from my overall goal. She shakes her head.
"No, mine's the other kind. I project powerful emotions."
I take a beat to retrace my steps to where this conversation went off the rails. "We don't have a guest room," I tell Dad. We don't even really have a couch right now. Julia's staying with us. I wave feebly toward the tower of clothes, pillows, and bedding. Dad's dark blonde brows knit together, a look of confusion, probably at being denied something he hasn't even fully bothered to ask for yet. Then he lets out a laugh.
"Oh, no," he says, shaking his head. "We wouldn't dream of imposing."
"Since when?"
No, I got us a motel room," he says. "It's a ways outside of town, but we don't mind ferrying back and forth."
This is a surprise indeed.
"Wait a second." Starfire's eyes widen. "I thought there were two bedrooms in here."
"There are?" Miles's eyes narrow, like if he focuses, he might be able to see her logic drifting through the room.
"And you don't use one as a guest room?" she asks.
"There are two of us," I point out.
"You two don't share a room?"
Dad says, dismayed. For the first time, Starfire's smile falters.
"Oh, no."
She almost sounds like she's going to cry. She looks between Miles and me.
"Do you want to talk about it? We can be like your mentors, your love mentors."
"What?" I say, as Miles says, "Love?" Starfire drops her voice to a whisper, like somehow that will keep the rest of us from hearing, and leans over to pat Miles's knee.
"You two will get through this."
"Get through what?"
Miles shakes his head, squinting again. Unfortunately, I'm not as lost as he is. "We're not together." He flinches when understanding hits.
"Oh, no!"
Starfire cries.
"You broke up?"
Her shoulders hitch. I genuinely think this woman I've never met is about to cry for a relationship that never happened.
"We're friends," Miles clarifies a little too frantically. "Just friends, separate rooms." "Oh, phew."
Dad eyes me and jerks a thumb at Miles.
"I like this guy. Glad I don't have to dislike him now, especially after what happened with the last guy. So, is anyone hungry? Would love to have a little belated birthday, kiddo."
"Of course, we don't want to intrude."
Starfire drapes a manicured hand over the crook of Dad's elbow.
"Since you weren't expecting us."
"Definitely,"
Dad says.
"We'll work around your schedule. Take whatever time you can spare for a couple of old coots."
Starfire scoffs and swats his arm.
"Oh, you take that back, JJ. You're only as old as you feel."
"This one feels about 22 most of the time,"
Dad tells me, adoration sparkling in his eyes. It triggers a confusing flurry of emotions in my chest, a softening toward this new incarnation of him, the one with an age-appropriate partner and the foresight to book a motel room, but also a reawakening of the old hurt, the reminder that my father never found a person he couldn't love more than he'd ever loved me or Mom, a place he didn't want to be more than he wanted to be at home.
"What do you say, kid?" he asks. "You got time to play tour guide for your dad and stepmom?"
Miles shoots me a look, brow raised, waiting for me to signal, leap over the coffee table and light something on fire while I climb out the window. And maybe I should. Maybe Dad's just setting a box of cupcakes atop a Trudaloo booby trap. But he's here, with a wife and a room already booked, and for the first time I can remember, he's asking whether I'm free, rather than assuming I'll drop everything because he's deigned to show up. "Is there room for two more in our plans?" I ask Miles. His head cocks. I can tell he's waiting for more of a signal than that, so I add, "We could probably make it work, right?" He holds my gaze for a second, giving me a chance to change my mind, to scream, "Ryan Reynolds!" at the top of my lungs. I don't. He turns a tamped-down version of his impishly charming smile toward them.
"You all bring bathing suits?"
Julia pokes her head back into the room without a hint of shame that she's obviously been eavesdropping from 1 foot out of sight.
"I knew it! We're going on the boat, aren't we?"
25. The boat is an old pontoon that belongs to a friend of Miles's. the hardware store slash barbershop owner where he gets his tools slash haircuts. Miles has an open invitation to use the pontoon whenever it's available. I drive, and Dad rides up front, with Miles, Julia, and Starfire wedged in my back seat, Miles giving verbal directions rather than using a GPS because he doesn't remember the guy's address. I'd assumed we'd be boating on Lake Michigan, but there are dozens of smaller lakes further inland from the 22,000 square miles of Lake Michigan. We're going to one of those, a lake in the more traditional sense of the word, with rustic cottages lining the water and reeds swaying in the shallows. We park down a long wooded drive in front of a gorgeous A-frame that's either halfway through being built or halfway through being renovated. My guess, based on the overgrown grass around a parked camper trailer and old truck, is the latter, that this place belongs to a do-it-yourselfer who's taking their time. Exactly the kind of person who'd operate a hardware store slash barbershop.
"You guys go ahead and get on the boat," Miles tells us as we get out into the buggy heat. "I'll grab the keys from inside."
"I thought your friend wasn't home," I say, but he's already bounding up to the back deck, sliding open a door that was apparently unlocked. Julia and I pull the cooler out of the trunk and carry it between us down the grassy hillside toward the water's edge.
"What a gorgeous day for this,"
Starfire says brightly. She said it 7 times so far. I've been counting.
"Couldn't have asked for better weather,"
Julia agrees, for the 4th time. We've been taking turns, and by now, I think she's caught on and is making a game out of it.
"Like Michigan rolled out the red carpet treatment,"
Dad says, clapping a hand on my shoulder, right as Julia and I set foot on the short dock that juts into the reeds. I wobble, but luckily manage to regain my footing before falling off the narrow pier and taking the cooler and Julia with me. It's seen better days. One board is missing, with 2 others snapped in the middle, but the boat looks to be in good shape. Not that I know what makes a boat in good shape, but it's not on fire or anything. Dad kicks off his shoes, picks them up, and hops aboard, helping each of us down by the hand. He passes Starfire down last and makes a big show of kissing her hand. She giggles and looks between me and Julia like, "Are you seeing this? What a guy!" I try to look pleasant and vaguely encouraging. "Yes, I saw my dad, Gomez Adams, you, and I think it's great." It is sweet, honestly. Again, that weird mishmash of emotions swirls in my ribcage. I like seeing him like this. I also resent it. Wonder for the millionth time why Mom and I never inspired this kind of attention or commitment.
"Got it,"
Miles calls, jogging down the dock. He unties the boat and jumps in, starting the engine, then pulling his shirt off. Starfire gasps at the assortment of disjointed tattoos this reveals. My initial blush and avoid looking tactic quickly dissolves into looking for a giant heart with Petra's name in it, but apparently that's not one of the many tattoo-related capital C choices he's committed to. I do, however, realize for the first time that in addition to his Popeye anchor, he also has a full-on Popeye on his calf. This does surprisingly little to dampen the impulse to cross the boat and run my tongue over his skin.
"What beautiful body art,"
Starfire coos.
"What's this one mean?"
She touches his upper biceps as he's starting to steer us deeper into the lake. He subdues his smile.
"Well," he says, "it's a mermaid."
She nods with wide-eyed intrigue.
"And?"
"I liked how it looked," he says.
"It's gorgeous."
She gives it a firm pat. The lake is surprisingly hopping. Over the roar of our motor, we catch snippets of radio hits blasting off the boats we pass. Taylor Swift's Cruel Summer and Sheryl Crow's Soak Up the Sun and Otis Redding's Sittin' on the Dock of the Bay. After 10 minutes of cruising, wind in our hair, motor rattling in our ears, we find a good spot to stop and relax. Miles turns on our radio, drops anchor, and passes out cans of seltzer and beer from the cooler to the rest of us. Julia and I slather ourselves in sunscreen, but Starfire wastes no time shucking her clothes off and jumping off the back of the boat, a blur of hot pink one piece and a whoop! Dad whistles and applauds when she resurfaces. Julia peels off her shorts and jumps out after her.
Is it cold?
I call to them.
Sort of,
Julia shouts back, right as Starfire says joyfully,
It feels like rebirth!
Within a few minutes of cajoling, Dad's gotten in too, and then he's badgering Miles and me from the water while Starfire backstrokes with impressive grace.
You getting in?
Miles asks me, shielding his eyes against the sun to peer at me. It makes the moment feel strangely private, intimate. How deep is it? I ask him.
Don't be a chicken,
Dad calls, the illusion of privacy shattering. Starfire makes a hyper-realistic chicken sound. She's really in her element here.
What exactly?
I step up to the gate at the back of the boat. Would I be afraid of in this scenario?
The fish,
Dad cries, like this should be obvious.
The fish,
I repeat. Dad affects a look of disbelief.
Are you kidding? You were terrified of them when you were a kid. Remember? I took you fishing and you had that meltdown?
I don't remember ever going fishing in my life, but if I did, I'm guessing the meltdown had less to do with the fish and more with having to pull a metal hook from its mouth.
Are you sure that was me?
He laughs.
I think I remember my own daughter. I took you fishing, and we forgot sunscreen, and I knew your mom would be mad, so we went to the grocery store and I got you this bright yellow sun hat. Matched your bathing suit. You looked like Tweety Bird,
he says, shaking his head.
You were obsessed with that hat.
I think about the beanie he sent me. Wonder if he conflated it with the hat from this memory. Honestly, I wonder if it's even a real memory. Or just some scene in a movie he overlaid my face onto after the fact.
You really don't remember?
He says. I shake my head. This clearly bothers him, but I can't think of anything comforting to say. The fact is, the most memorable parts of my childhood are the ones he missed, his absence exactly what gave them their weight.
It was a really special day,
he murmurs, treading water in place, mouth turned down in a frown. I hate that I feel guilt right now. I don't want to feel like Dad can still trigger that in me. Like all I want is to make him happy, make him proud, earn his shine. Miles catches my eyes, his smile gone, his hand cupped around his eyes against the sun, creating that illusion of seclusion again. It's a look like, you good? Or maybe like, I'm here. And I know he won't be forever. Or maybe even very long, but it helps knowing that right now he is. That can be enough. I turn toward the water, pulling my dress over my shoulders, sun beating against them.
On the bright side, I say, since I don't remember that, I'm definitely not afraid of fish.
I toss my dress at the bench, step through the open gate, and leap into the water. The cold rushes over my head, needles through my every pore. When I come up, when the sun hits the crown of my head,